You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the past two decades, Hamas has been labeled a terrorist organization, while it's also been the democratically elected governing party of the Palestinian people. In his latest book, Kill Khalid, The Failed Mossad Assassination of Khalid Mishal and the Rise of Hamas, Paul McGough, the chief foreign correspondent for Australia's Sydney Morning Herald, tells the inside story of Hamas, the botched assassination attempt on one of its most powerful leaders by the Israeli intelligence agency, and all of its unforeseen consequences. It's published by the New Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. McGough to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me here.
So who is Khalid Mishal?
Khalid Mishal is a 50-something Palestinian whose family fled the West Bank in 1967, in the days after the Six-Day War. He was 11 years old then. At that time, Yasser Arafat was a seasoned guerrilla. This man was 11 years old at that time. He became a nationalist at heart because of that experience at age 15. According to his brothers, he became an avowed Islamist following the strict spiritual regime of the Muslim Brotherhood. And by the 1980s, he was his cover was that of a physics teacher in Kuwait, but he was in fact running a very sophisticated covert cell, if you like, which was devising the whole framework that was to become Hamas.
But he had also studied physics, obviously.
He had. He studied physics at Kuwait University.
Now, as I understand it, Hamas initially was not a political organization. It was more like a religiously based social welfare organization. So was he one of the people who changed it?
He was. You've got to go back to the 1980s in Gaza. The Islamist movement was, in the guise of the Muslim Brotherhood, was active.
Well, that's Egyptian, basically.
It was Egyptian, but you have to remember that Gaza was, for a time, controlled by Egypt, and Gaza was quite a part of Egyptian society and the broader Egyptian community. Not officially, but there was a lot of movement backwards and forwards, and what happened with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt filtered into Gaza, and there was a very strong Brotherhood movement in Gaza under the leadership of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Now, he was very active in setting up the sort of the Islamist community organizations, clinics, schools, kindergartens, universities. And the Israelis thought this was a wonderful thing. The Israelis thought that this was a great thing because they believed that if they encouraged the Islamists, then they would be a foil for Yasser Arafat and Fatah and the PLO, and that the Israelis could stand back and watch these two go head-to-head themselves.
Did the Islamists see it that way?
They never wanted to admit that they saw it that way, because the Islamists never want to admit that they were encouraged by the Israelis. You'll often hear references to Mahmoud Abbas or the Fatah interest in faction in the West Bank being accused of riding into Gaza on the back of an Israeli tank. The same applies to the Islamists. They don't want to acknowledge that they were encouraged, but indeed they were.
In one of the first chapters of your book, you give us the modern history behind the current Israeli-Palestinian conflict in just 13 pages. That must have been a real chore, because so much of this, it seems to me to be a tit-for-tat kind of history.
I mean, therein lies the senselessness of it, that it's almost impossible to pick a point in the cycles of this history and say, that's a starting point, or that's the point from which we must look at the future and where this crisis goes. I mean, my sense is that both sides in this crisis are so punch drunk from dealing with each other in pretty merciless terms for the best part of 60 years now, that they're not capable anymore of resolving it. But yes, trying to grind it down into a meaningful passage that would set the scene for readers before taking them into what Hamas is about was indeed a challenge.
Well, 60 years would say it all began with the creation of the State of Israel, but it goes back a lot earlier, doesn't it?
Indeed. It goes back. We could argue that it goes back to the Basel Conference, so we're talking about, you know, around 100 years.
What role did Khalid play in Hamas?
The role that he played was he discerned that Yasser Arafat and Fatah, in the critical moves that they made, which were one, to renounce violence as a weapon, and two, to recognize the state of Israel, his view was that these were two, if you like, sins against the Palestinian people, because these were, according to Khaled Mishaal, these were the last cards to be played in any negotiation. And by negotiation, I use the word in its broadest terms, whether it's sitting down to, at a table to talk or whether it's shooting at each other. His view was that you do not surrender these two options because they are all you've got.
But the other argument could be, if you set that as a goal, then you can negotiate. You still have all the cards in your hand, don't you?
You still have the cards, but if you surrender those two as a community in the circumstances in which the Palestinian people live, you have nothing to put back on the table in the event that things aren't working.
Well, hasn't that worked against Hamas, at least in the way the world has viewed it, because it has seemed so hardline and so intractable that it didn't seem to be any possibility of those cards being played?
You would have thought so, but if you look at events in recent years, I mean, the Oslo process is in grave risk of collapsing on itself if it hasn't already collapsed. I mean, the notion that there is still an Oslo process, that we are still working with the formula of land for peace, that's pretty well finished now.
And a two-state solution seems to be imperiled as well.
A two-state solution is imperiled. But again, it can't be abandoned. I mean, the demographics of the region now don't allow the Israelis to think in terms of a one-state solution. When we talk about one-state solution now, that's usually a code, more often than not, for saying, "Well, we'll shove the Palestinians out, we'll push them across the Jordan River into Jordan, and leave it out for King Abdullah to sort them out."
Does anybody really seriously propose that approach?
It comes up every now and again in Israeli discourse. Yes, it was before Christmas. There were lots of pieces in the Israeli press resurrecting it as a way to go. And when you get policies such as Benjamin Netanyahu's, who's now about to become prime minister again, saying he is opposed. Yeah, look, picture the landscape in the region at the moment. We have Hamas, to a point, saying we accept a two-state solution.
But they've also said we want to drive the Israelis into the sea. Isn't that just the other side of the same coin?
Well, yes and no. Yes and no. There's two issues here. One is you've got Netanyahu saying, I don't accept a two-state solution. Let's give them economic independence, whatever that might be. On the other, you've got this hoary old chestnut of the Hamas charter. And I was in Damascus just 2 weeks ago, and this was the main issue that I wanted to talk to Khaled Mishaal about. Because as I see the international stage, diplomatic stage at the moment, we're at a point where with the advent of the Obama presidency in Washington, we're at a point where gestures are as important as anything else. What can people do to make each other welcome each other to a different process, to a dialogue that has a different tone? Now, the obvious thing that Hamas needs to do and should do is to rewrite its charter. This charter is a 1988 document. It is vile. It is anti-Semitic. It is an incitement to war. It is a crass, ugly piece of work.
Was it written by Khalil Mishaal?
No, it wasn't. It was written by a group of men in Gaza at the height of the Intifada, 1988, at a very ugly time, very ugly sentiment, and it's a document that no self-respecting political movement or militia movement, for that matter, should want to have. But it's there. It exists. But in reality, it is of no great moment, because Hamas has taken several critical policy changes that have rendered it redundant. Hamas has said it will accept a two-state solution. It hasn't said that it's junking its claim to all of the land from the river to the sea, because its view is that that's a decision that can't be made by this generation of Palestinians. What they've said is they will accept a two-state solution. They will accept any peace proposal that is endorsed at referendum by the Palestinian people. They will happily defer to a future generation, and by that they're talking 20, 30 years hence, to make a final call on their claim on the land that is Israel.
So they're saying 20 years down the line we may open up new warfare and try to reconquer this land.
Well, they are, but let me tell you what would happen. If you could get 20 years of peace, if you could give Palestinians 20 years in which they're not afraid of their homes being bombed, if they're not afraid of not being able to get supplies in their stores, if they're not afraid of their power stations, their water treatment plants being bombed, if their children can go to school, if they can live the life that Israelis live, if they could live the life that your family and my family live, I think they would forget about it. It would be so unimportant.
My guest is Paul Magot. His book, Kill Khalid, The Failed Mossad Assassination of Khalid Mashal and the Rise of Hamas. It's published by the New Press. Well, David Grossman, the Israeli writer and novelist and political writer, told me some years back that he thought that, in his mind, a two-state solution would be the best. But he assumed that there would be this period of some years in which there would be terrorists or whatever kind of activity you want to describe it on both sides, and that would cause a lot of tension. But in time, people would recognize that it was in the best interests of both sides to effect some kind of peace, because it would be economically in everybody's best interest, and also just it would end the killing.
Well, it's quite interesting that Barack Obama has brought George Mitchell into the process, because Mitchell brings his vast Northern Irish experience. Now, the critical point that was reached in Northern Ireland was exhaustion. Exhaustion on both sides. Now, what happens when you have a resistance movement is the resistance movement sets a price, and the occupier says, we will pay the price or we will not pay the price. And until you arrive at that point where the price is not worth it anymore, or the resistance force can't keep the price up to force the hand of the occupation force, you don't get to that point. But Grossman is right. There has to come a point.
Although even in Northern Ireland, we're still seeing outbreaks of violence.
So you're talking to an Irishman here. I live in Australia, but I'm from Ireland. I grew up on the border as a child. I know it well. I grew up discovering caches of weapons hidden as a child and that sort of thing. Northern Ireland is coming back into a period of violence. But what we've had in the last 10 years is better than we had in the previous 20 years.
So, describe the attempt on Khalid Mashal's life by Mossad. How many Mossad agents were involved, and what was their plan?
It's a remarkable story. It's a remarkable story that they thought they could get away with it. And while their plan, their concept was quite brilliant, it was so bungled that it was one of the most severe embarrassments or humiliations of the Mossad in its long and rather glorious history.
What did they do?
Mashal, for starters, lived in Jordan. He lived in Amman. Now, Amman was the capital of King Hussein of Jordan, a rarity in the Middle East in that he was an ally of Washington. He was an Arab ally of the Israelis. And yet, the Mossad thought... Now, there was great anger in Israel at this time. You've got to remember, it was 1979, lots of suicide bombings, two in particular in July and August of 1997, that killed great numbers of people in Jerusalem. Benjamin Netanyahu, as now, back then, was a prime minister. He demanded that there be revenge, and a cabinet decision was taken that they would strike anywhere in the world. Of anywhere in the world, they chose Amman. The risks of destabilizing King Hussein were very, very serious. The brilliance of the plan was they were going to walk... Mossad agents were going to walk down the street, one coming towards Mashal, one going away from him. As one passed him, he would shake open a can of Coca-Cola, There would be fizz, there would be spray, there would be moisture in the air. And while Michelle was distracted by this, the second agent was going to use a nebulizer, which was concealed in a camera, to spray a dose of a modified, chemically modified painkiller called fentanyl. In its modified form, it was called lofentanyl, and it ceased to be a painkiller and in that form became a human killer. They were going to spray the lofentanyl into his ear. Now, here's where the brilliance of the plan defeated the plan. Lofentanyl is a drug that kills quickly, and ideally you want it absorbed into the bloodstream quickly. But they did not want Michal or anyone around him to associate the symptoms that he would experience from this drug with the encounter in the street. So if you wanted to kill quickly with it, you would put it on somebody's tongue, you would put it into soft tissue, get it into the bloodstream, get it to the brain. And what it does is it sends the brain to sleep. You feel tired, you lie down, and you surrender your respiratory system to death. That was the plan. But because they wanted slow absorption so that he would leave the scene and go home and maybe feel a bit sleepy after his lunch, they put it in the ear so that it would be absorbed slowly through the membrane of the ear. And, of course, by giving themselves that slow time to kill him, they gave the Jordanian monarchy and its medical staff the time in which to save him.
And also made Khalid quite aware of the fact that there'd been an attempt on his life.
Absolutely, absolutely.
My guest is Paul Migaud. His book, Kill Khalid, the failed Mossad assassination of the leader of Hamas. It's published by the New Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Paul Migaud, M-C-G-E-O-U-G-H, chief correspondent and former editor of Australia's Sydney Morning Herald, author of three books on the Middle East, twice been named Australian Journalist of the Year. In 2002, was awarded a Johns Hopkins University-based SAIS Novartis Prize for Excellence in International Journalism. His latest book is called Kill Khalid, The Failed Mossad Assassination of Khalid Michal and the Rise of Hamas. It is published by the New Press. So what happened as a result of this? The Jordanian government must have been upset. What was the response in Tel Aviv, and what was the, or Jerusalem, was Jerusalem already the capital of Israel at the time?
Yes, it was.
And what about Washington?
Well, the drama unfolded very quickly because as soon the point that changed the whole balance of power in this drama as it unfolded was that Michal's bodyguards captured two of the Mossad agents. They were thrown into an Israeli prison, and that meant that King Hussein had two aces to play. It wasn't often that he got aces to play in dealing with Israel, but in this case he had them. The worst thing that can happen with the Israeli forces, the Israeli security forces, intelligence forces, as we see almost daily with stories on the fate of Gilad Shalit in Gaza, the captured Israeli sergeant as he is now, is that the Israeli government will get into huge trouble if a man is left on the battlefield, be he dead or alive. So Israel had to get them back. King Hussein was not going to give them back without addressing a whole series of issues. For King Hussein was in a precarious position. Half his population was Palestinian refugees.
He'd already had a war with the Palestinians at an earlier time.
Dead right, in 1970, Black September and all of that. You know, the blowing up of the first hijacked aircraft on his territory and the rest of it. He was deeply distrusted in significant capitals of the Arab world and also in the Islamic world because of his relationship with Israel, because of his relationship with Washington. He was a friend of the West in a part of the world where the West didn't have too many friends. So for Netanyahu to treat him this way was an incredibly cavalier approach to Netanyahu's own problems in Israel. All of that being the case, King Hussein decided that to save himself, I mean, he seriously thought his throne was at risk. It was that severe for him. He decided the only way he could save himself was to save the life of Khalid Michal. Now, he did one. He did something that's rarely done. He picked up the phone and called the White House. Now, he didn't call for an ambassador to organize with the West Wing to see if President Clinton would be available. He picked up the phone and said, "This is King Hussein of Jordan. I need to speak to President Clinton." Clinton wasn't available at the time. He was, in fact, in Arkansas. He was on a dais at a public function. Sandy Berger, his national security advisor, couldn't be found. King Hussein was put through to Bruce Rydell, who is back in with the current administration, helping on Afghan policy at the moment. And, of course, King Hussein refused to tell him what was happening other than to say that there's a crisis in the Middle East. A lot of telephone tag went on, but ultimately King Hussein laid down his conditions, and I've interviewed people who were listening in on the phone calls between King Hussein and Bill Clinton, and the anger that King Hussein revealed in those phone calls was described as being hot enough to peel the paint off the walls. What he demanded was that President Clinton order the Israelis to hand over a dose of the poison used, a detailed description of the poison, and an antidote. Their big concern was that they wanted to make sure that the antidote would work with the poison to neutralize it, because they were very concerned that if they accepted anything from the Israelis, there was the risk that they would be given another dose of poison to finish the dirty work, if you like.
So that but it's interesting that it's the poison is taking this. This is taking some time, and the poison is rather slow acting, isn't it?
The poison is rather slow acting, but what has happened is that the Jordanian medical team have put, they've put Mashal into suspension. They've put him on a ventilator. They're running what they think might be an antidote, but they don't know. What they think is an antidote, they're running that through his body, trying to simply keep him suspended and alive while they work out what to do and how to do it. Now, there was another track because, of course, the Israelis were insisting on their own course of action, and that came to light quite dramatically with a phone call to Dennis Ross. Dennis Ross was Bill Clinton's special envoy to the Middle East. It wasn't often that he got to spend a Saturday morning at home, sleeping in his own bed, given the amount of travel he did. Now, at 7:30 in the morning on the Saturday in September 97, the phone rang. It was a White House switchboard saying that they had Benjamin Netanyahu on the phone and they wished to patch him through on a secure line. Now, at that point, Dennis Ross did not have to be told another thing. Merely by being told that Benjamin Netanyahu was not in bed at that time of day, told him there was a crisis. He was so familiar with Netanyahu's personal habits, he knew that Netanyahu spent all day Saturday in bed, catching up on the sleep that he never had during the week. And if he was up and about on what was 2:30 in the afternoon, Jerusalem time, he knew there was a crisis. And indeed there was.
My guest is Paul McGough. His book, Kill Khalid, which is published by the New Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Khalid knows that Netanyahu was behind the assassination attempt, and Netanyahu is now about to become the new prime minister of Israel. What does that bode for relations between Hamas and Israel? Is there a kind of a political reality accepted here, or is the grudge? You've spoken to Khalid. Is he holding a big grudge?
I raised this question with him because I'm intrigued by it, because having researched the personal relationships and enmity at work in the Middle East crisis over the last 30 years, I think not since the sort of intense personal standoffs between Arafat and Ariel Sharon have we got to the sense that we have got two people now in leadership positions, significant leadership positions on either side of this crisis, where one tried to kill the other and very nearly got away with it. And because he didn't, the would-be killer was deeply, deeply humiliated in the region. So there obviously has to be a personal dynamic at work here that otherwise wouldn't be at work were they two other individuals. And I raised this with Khalid Mashal in Damascus, and I said, how's this going to play out? You know, how do you deal with it? And his view was, and expressed in typical Palestinian and typical Hamas fashion, was, look, Benjamin Netanyahu is just another prime minister. He's just another Israeli prime minister. It doesn't really matter to us who is the prime minister of Israel, as long as they are prepared to negotiate with us. He said, we will not be setting policy based on personal grudges.
Israelis say, well, you know, Ariel Sharon, a man who they considered one of the bitterest enemies for years, closed down all the Israeli settlements in Gaza, and Gaza is what Hamas controls. Why isn't Hamas happy with that?
Because Gaza is still utterly controlled by Israel. It's more correct to describe what happened in 2005 in Gaza as Israel withdrawing to the perimeter of Gaza as opposed to withdrawing from Gaza.
Well, it hasn't stopped the people in Gaza from sending missiles over the border.
No, it hasn't, utterly. I mean, what's happened with the – there's been a significant change in Hamas's use of terror as a weapon, and it's been quite a calculated change. Originally, it was suicide bombs on a regular basis that would kill dozens of people in the places where people ordinarily expect to be able to go in the course of their daily lives. Now what you have is, instead of the bombings, which were getting them very bad publicity internationally and caused quite a debate within the movement as to the appropriateness of the bombings, now what you've got is these flying stovepipes, as some Israeli analysts describe them. They're erratic, they're inaccurate, they don't kill anywhere near as many people as the suicide bombs did. I mean, the reality of the number of people killed by the rockets coming out of Gaza is they've killed 20-odd people, which is not to be belittled, but by comparison with the suicide bombings, it's a very different equation. But it frightens more Israelis, because Israelis, there are far bigger numbers of Israelis living within firing range, and they don't know where, how, and when these rockets might land.
Despite those dangers in the court of world opinion, Israel has suffered quite a bit recently. It suffered for its recent incursion into Gaza. It suffered for any number of things, the complicated wall that's being built on the West Bank, and I'm sure it'll suffer more now that Benjamin Netanyahu is prime minister. It's being reported that he is opposed to a two-state solution. He's brought in some real hardliners into his government, and we can assume that tensions are going to mount. So what are the prospects for Israel right now?
The prospects for Israel are grim. There's been significant change in the sense of Israel's ability to control the narrative and the spin, if you like, of the Middle East crisis in the last few years. Perhaps one of the classic turning points for Israel was the invasion of Lebanon in 2006. It was,
which was opposed by many Israelis as well.
It was opposed by many Israelis, but if you were there on the ground, as I was, and saw what took place and saw the extent of the infrastructure of ordinary living that was damaged, as opposed to the infrastructure of terrorism. I mean, there's a frequent commentary in Israel, and it's justified, about needing to remove, deal with, or challenge what they describe as the infrastructure of terror. But when you deal with the infrastructure of people's daily lives, power stations, water treatment plants, I mean, the road from Beirut down to the border along the Mediterranean, there is overpass after overpass on that road, which was bombed. Every overpass was bombed. It was merciless. And what happened in Gaza in over Christmas, January just past, was the same. Another exercise of, merciless punishment is what it was. And it wasn't just about Hamas. This was about punishing Palestinians.
What is Khalid Mishal's current role in Hamas and his current standing in Palestinian politics?
His current standing in Palestinian politics is high, higher than it was pre-Gaza, and the same applies for the Hamas movement. Hamas has been ascendant in Palestinian politics since it won the election
of 2006, January 2006. Now, that was a remarkable achievement for a resistance movement. Go back to 2005. The election was approaching. Everyone expected that Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah movement, the traditional receptacle of Palestinian nationalism, you know, the those who inherited the mantle of Yasser Arafat would win the election, so much so that when Hamas said that they would stand candidates in that election, the Israelis said, no, no, no. And the Israelis immediately called Washington and said, pleaded with Washington to intervene to block Hamas from standing candidates. And the response from Fatah, from Mahmoud Abbas, was, I don't have the power to stop them. We have to let them run candidates. They will lose the election, and then I'll smack them down for you afterwards. And, of course, they won the election. So they went to the election with a ballot in one hand and a bomb in the other, and they won.
Listeners have written in to point out that Hamas has never recognized a two-state solution. We kind of talked about that earlier, but they have only proposed a long ceasefire, which will give them time to form a stronger terrorist state, according to that listener. Another one points out that one of the real sticking points to a two-state solution is the right of return, and that is something that does seem and Jerusalem to a lesser degree,
sure, sure.
as a capital of both states. These seem to be close to insoluble.
They are close to insoluble. I mean, this is the I mean, if these things were easy to address, they would have been addressed a long time ago.
But you get the feeling at times that that there are people there who just do not want to resolve this. And whether you're looking at it from the Palestinian side, you would say it's the Israelis. If you're looking at it from the Israeli side, you would say that it's the Palestinians.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What you've just said is correct. There are people on both sides who don't want a resolution. My sense is,
why wouldn't they? That's what I don't understand. Wouldn't peace be a better prospect?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Peace is the only prospect. It's the only prospect worth holding out for. This idea that this can go on and on forever, I don't believe it can. I believe exhaustion must set in. But I also don't believe that the Israelis or the Palestinians, anyone on either side, is capable anymore of resolving this. I mean, they have gone head to head for so long that they're not able. My view is that you will only get a settlement to work now if it is imposed.
And that would be very difficult to do, don't you think?
It would be very difficult, if not impossible. I mean, you could look around it. You could if you wanted to play. I did this the other night, where I looked at all of the different options that have been on the table for possible settlements, and you could do some very interesting things. Leave the wall there. Use the wall as a positive instead of a negative. Say that we will set up the Palestinian economy in the West Bank and Gaza, hooking them into the Arab economies, not the Israeli economy. Why do we always look to hook them into the Israeli economy? Turn them the other way. Instead of Washington being on the front line of negotiations all the time, maybe Washington should step back. I mean, one of the realities of Washington's endless involvement and at times unrelenting involvement in trying to find an answer is that Washington has never been a party to the major developments that have given us the most hope. Anwar Sadat's visit to Jerusalem, that was sprung on Washington. Oslo, that was sprung on Washington. And the most recent talks brokered by Turkey between Syria and Israel, that was sprung on Washington and actively discouraged by Washington. Now, it's often occurred to me that perhaps if Washington, and again, this new atmosphere that we have with the Obama administration, and, you know, poor Barack Obama, there is so much hope invested in that poor man. I mean, what a time to become president of the U.S. But I'm interested in his push to find some sort of détente or dialogue with Tehran, with Damascus, and if those big picture issues that need to be addressed there, in particular Afghanistan policy, in particular Iraq policy, maybe if those things can be advanced one way or another, something might slip out of the bottom of that process that goes towards resolving the Middle East crisis.
Paul Magot's book is called Kill Khalid, the Failed Mossad Assassination of Khalid Mishal and the Rise of Hamas. It's published by the New Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.